Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this February the 25th on the West Coast, now February the 26th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, especially those that are able to hear us over there near Christchurch, New Zealand. Our prayers and thoughts are with you. We are following what's going on very carefully and very closely. Of course, you have to understand here in the U.S., a lot of information is being withheld from us. So anything we find out is through our network of friends throughout the world, and Wind Talker certainly plays a role in that. That said, there's a lot of chaos going on. We've talked about that for the past couple of months, actually. This week we've been focusing on a lot of the disinformation that's out there. Things are getting pretty desperate for the, quote, powers that be, unquote. They're nervous because a lot of truth is coming out, and there's going to be more truth coming out when we bring on tonight's guest, Jim Murray. But first, I'm going to allow Little Feet to deliver a message. And this is Day or Night.
People running, talking, it's all
That's Little Feet and Day or Night. Day or Night. We're going to bring you the truth here on Evident Footprints. Depending on where you are, where I am, it's already night. Where tonight's guest is, it's already night. In many places around the world and even on other planets throughout the galaxy. Yes, I said even on other planets. There are other planets, folks. And there are people on other planets. And guess what? They can listen to radio just like we can. And they can listen to many, many shows that are broadcast from planet Earth. Not all of them. And I can guarantee you there aren't many watching reality TV. But they are interested in what's happening here on planet Earth. Maybe more so than the people on planet Earth are interested in what's happening on planet Earth. Consider that when we bring tonight's guest on board. He is my weekly co-host, a resident science advisor. Why? He's a scientist, an inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher. And as I said, my co-host, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Yes, Don, thank you. You sound like you're in good spirits tonight.
I'm always in good spirits, Jim. Whether I sound like it or not, it's a different story. But I'm always.
Well, don't forget, that's all I got to go on, you know, being over 1,000 miles away from you and not being able to see your face.
Well, you're not missing anything. Jim, on some past shows, I can say throughout 2010, in fact, you and I did a whole series of shows on consciousness. And sort of breaking the mold that's been cast to keep people contained within a belief system that's extremely limited. And despite what we're told about scientific reality, you bring something totally different to the table, as some other scientists before your time did in many ways. And we're still fighting this battle for the truth to come out. It's ridiculous what's going on this planet. When you consider that on other planets, people have evolved technologically, physically, mentally, and spiritually, and really the essence is the spirit. They're quite aware of that. It's ridiculous what is occurring on this planet, and how low the vibration of activity is. Even the way the technology is used, even though they can use high frequencies, it's done for low frequency purposes, wreaking havoc and mayhem and destruction on the upon the planet, upon nature, upon its ecosystems, the geological structures that support continents, continental shelves, the oceans, the air. And it's moved out into space. And we have problems that are just being ignored, flushed down the toilet, energy being one, the source of our energy, and the ways that we could use what's here naturally. I'm not talking about mining and those things, just talking about the things that you and I have discussed, the work of Nikola Tesla, for example. And there are simple answers, and those are cast aside and used maybe secretly for the benefit of those that are using the rest of his inventions to undermine us, to prevent us from being free and from being creative and from being who we are. And I know you want to talk about some of those things tonight, so have at it.
Well, it's interesting your choice of words, you know, preventing us from being free. Well, you know, this planet of ours has the reputation of being a slave planet. And it's not just that we're slaves to the economic and financial system, but we're also intellectually kept in slavery because the stuff that they teach is just a minuscule particle of what's already available. Our school systems are absolutely terrible, and they only let you know what they want you to know, you know, to fit into a particular category. And the terror of it is that the people who come out of these educational institutions are so brainwashed that they're proud of the fact that they only know what they know, and they don't want to know anymore. And they have certificates to prove it. It's really bizarre. I was talking to a guy here this week that professes to have a great interest in some of the research I'm involved with. And I let my hair down a little bit. We started having a discussion about power sources and things of that sort. And he says, and this guy was bragging about the fact that he has two different PhDs in electrical engineering. He didn't specify what they were, but he bragged about having two of them anyway. And so the discussion led to some of Tesla's concepts, and I was trying to explain to him the worth and the validity of oscillating power as opposed to just oscillating current and voltage in a given system. You can also encourage the power to oscillate. And I said, for instance, if you applied that technology to a motor, you know, you would have a situation where you would essentially do, you would have to supply less power to the motor from the lines to do the same amount of work as the motors we have today would require. And he just went ballistic, and he said, don't you realize that if you could do that, he said, then you could use that motor to run a crane, and you could use the crane to lift a great big weight, and you'd lift that weight to a certain height, and then that height would represent potential energy that was actually in excess to what you used to run the motor to lift it. And he said, that's a violation of physical law, and you can't have that, and blah, blah, blah. And he got so cranked up over that issue that he didn't even allow the explanation to be forthcoming. The interesting thing, which people don't seem to get, they are so brainwashed with this concept of conservation of energy that they don't realize two things. First thing is, energy is always conserved. But it doesn't make any difference. Because energy isn't the agency that gives us the things that we want. It's power that does that. You know, and it's very easy to say, oh, but energy is the time integral of power. Well, I already know that. But the thing that's eluding everybody is we think in terms of energy just like water going through a pipe. Okay, so their concern is that if you pour in a gallon of water at one end of the pipe and the pipe spills over into a tub of water on the floor, there's no way I can put 1 gallon in one end and get 5 gallons out the other end. And to them, that's just absolutely unheard of. You know, it's a violation of everything. But who's thinking that way? They are. I'm not. Tesla wasn't. The only thing that they were trying to say is that if you scrutinize the laws of conservation of energy, what they say literally is energy can either be created nor destroyed, but only changed from one form to another. But then there's an unspoken second half of that law, which also says that there's no limit to how many times energy can be allowed to change its form from one form to another. It's only dependent upon your ingenuity and the efficiency with which you can engender these transformations. So getting back to the water through the pipe issue, it's not a question of pouring in 1 gallon and getting out 5. It's a question of pouring in 1 gallon and getting out 0.95 gallons and then reusing that over and over again instead of always throwing away what's left and going back to your supply for another gallon or another unit of energy. And for some reason, they just can't grasp that concept. And I don't understand it because it's so intuitively obvious, at least to me. What is the problem with it? I'd like to hear your point of view.
Well, as I listened to you talk, and how did you state that energy is a fraction of power in time? Is that how you state?
Oh, no. I said energy is defined as the time integral of power, which means that if you integrate a function which is representative of power, the result that you get will be will give you the idea of what energy actually is. But a simpler non-mathematical way of saying it is this. Supposing we film a guy throwing a cannonball off a roof, and we film that cannonball coming all the way down until it buries itself in the ground, right? Now we play the film back. After it's developed, we play it back. And from the time the guy releases the cannonball and the thing drops through space and comes all the way down and actually hits the grass at the bottom of the building, that entire event, that continuum throughout the whole drop, is power. That's representative of the power involved. Mm-hmm. But if we stop the picture and examine any discrete frame, that's what energy is. It's a snapshot.
Yes.
that takes time out of the picture, but it gives you a relative measurement of progress with respect to something.
Yeah, and say cycles per second, for example, right?
I'm sorry?
Cycles per second, let's say, if you were measuring electricity in terms of its power rating.
Yeah, well, that would be power. And then somehow if you took the time out of the thing and instead of having a series of waves moving along, you just were looking at one stationary one, you could examine it that way and get an idea of its geometry and its magnitude and what have you, but it wouldn't be capable of doing anything. And that's the irony of it. We relate everything to energy, which can't do anything. When the real agent that does work for us in real time is power.
Yes. Now, what went through my mind as you were describing this man's reaction, I don't know if he was a gentleman. It didn't sound like he was, so I'm not going to call him one. But his reaction spawned in me the question, well, what about the energy that's able to transcend time, where time is no longer a factor?
Well, that's the whole point.
Yes.
Energy only exists where there is no time. And they're trying to make us think about it as if it's something that occupies a position in the real world. You know, strictly speaking, spiritual entities that are wherever the divinity happens to be, where there is no time, those individuals can perceive energy as it really is. But in our world, you can't really perceive energy unless you put yourself in the right reference frame to do so. Or, putting it another way, you can perceive energy in its potential state. Like, for instance, I can hold a pound of coal in my hand, and I can say, you know, that this represents 100,000 joules, you know, of energy or whatever the equivalent is in heat or BTUs, you know, and I'll be correct. But I can't do anything with it. You have to release it. You have to make it work. It's the same thing as having some kind of a bomb. You know, you can have a bomb in your living room. It would just be sitting there. You can use it for an ornament.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do anything until it goes off. But when it's in its quiescent state, that represents energy, which is defined as the ability to do work. But it isn't doing any work. It's only the ability to do work. When it goes off and blows your whole house up, now it did something. But then the agency that was at work at that time was not energy, it was power. And for some reason, which I really don't understand, they can't get that through their heads. They talk about them as if they're interchangeable, and they're not.
Well, when you describe the cannonball, Jim, dropped off the top of a building and hitting the ground and possibly making a dent in the ground, burying itself somewhat into the ground because of the velocity and the mass and the force, when you take that cannonball out of there, even though there has been energy expended and it's displaced the whatever it struck upon landing, making contact with the ground, the cannonball still has the potential to do the same thing again, does it not, as long as it's still the whole cannonball?
Well, sure, but you see, you got to do work upon it to make that happen. In other words, when the guy lugged it up 30 flights of stairs to get to the roof of the apartment building, he was charging that cannonball with potential energy by virtue of the muscles in his legs as he labored to lug the thing up the stairs. Mm-hmm. So now, when he's at the roof, let's say the building's 100 feet tall and the cannonball weighs 10 pounds, okay? So that's 1,000 foot-pounds of potential energy that he has in that ball when he reaches the roof. But it wasn't always in there. He put it in there when he walked up the stairs with it.
Well,
so if you drop the thing off the roof and it comes whistling down, sure, it'll expend that energy by deforming the soil in the yard when it hits. But the cannonball is only the carrier. So, yeah, you can use it again, but you got to recharge it.
Now, imagine dropping it on a trampoline and having it go back up on its own.
Well, I'll give you a better one. Think about this. Supposing that we start off on the first floor of the building, but on the backside of the building is a cliff, okay, and the cliff continues down for another 15 or 20 feet or something like that. And we carry the cannonball up to the roof, and it's the same height as it was before. It's 100 feet, and the cannonball weighs 10 pounds. Okay, so now when I drop that thing off, the instant that it passes the mark that represents ground zero, okay, theoretically, all of the potential energy has now been converted into kinetic energy, okay? Notwithstanding the fact that it's going to acquire more because of the additional drop. But my point is, when the velocity that it acquires on the way down is a maximum, let's say, at ground zero with respect to where we started with the situation, and everybody says, well, okay, yeah, the kinetic energy that you have is rigorously equal to the potential energy that you started with. And they write the equation, you know, mgh is equal to 1/2 mv squared, and they solve that, and they can tell you the velocity and all these other, and the acceleration and all these other characteristics about what just happened. But you know something? They always leave something very interesting out of the picture. And that is that that cannonball, when it was being pulled down through that height, actually the Earth's gravitational field was doing work on it. So there's this other condition which is ignored because the focus seems to be on the relationship between the potential energy that you start with and the kinetic energy that you wind up with. But the interesting thing is, when the ball hits that ground zero, kinetic energy is the maximum, but it has also been worked upon the whole way down. It actually did work. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be investigated more deeply, which is one of the reasons I get into this whole field, because I was interested in finding out if the relationship between the ability to do work and the available energy are always a one-to-one correspondence, and guess what? They're not.
Mm-hmm. So in what you just pointed out in that example, and I understand, I still like the idea of my trampoline, but I understand what you're saying. Now, so that's ignored. So in ignoring that, then, are they ignoring the fact that that energy or that work could be converted into power, usable power?
Well, it was. You see, that's the problem. It was usable power on the way down. The thing that makes it so difficult, I think, for people to follow is that you have to switch your reference frame back and forth.
Yes.
And people aren't used to doing that, you know, while they're being cognizant of an event. But to give you an example, let's say we go back to the cannonball situation. The guy's on the roof with the cannonball. Okay, so relative to his position and relative to the ground, that thing has maximum potential energy. So the potential energy is exactly that. It's a potential. It's the ability to do work in the future. It hasn't done anything yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we drop it off the building and it goes whistling down, if you stand there and you watch it go down, relative to your position, you can say, oh, look, that thing's accelerating, and it's got a certain amount of kinetic energy with respect to the way I'm observing it. But if you jump off with it on the way down, the interesting thing is, in your reference frame, the kinetic energy of that ball is still a potential. And what I mean by that is that regardless of how much kinetic energy it acquires on dropping through the gravitational gradient, the only way that that becomes accessible is if it involves another acceleration, which would be stopping. So when the thing surrenders all of that momentum to the ground and deforms the ground by putting a hole in it, that's when it does work. But before it actually hits the ground, even though it's kinetic energy, and that's defined as the energy of motion, it's actually a it's actually a potential energy, but it's in a different reference frame.
Okay.
I don't know if that helps you or hinders your understanding, but the point is...
I do get it, but what I'm seeing is if you interject something else into the equation, a different surface that causes the ball to keep moving and in another direction, okay? Obviously, when it hits the trampoline, it most likely, if it was coming straight down, let's say perpendicular to the earth, then it's going to go straight back up, provided that the trampoline is situated in such a way to permit it to do that. But I'm looking at the possibility that it doesn't have to stop there, that it can keep going.
As long as there's no losses, that's not a problem.
Yes. So there should be, and what's being ignored, there should be a way to possibly capture more potential energy.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is the interesting fact that the relationship between work and energy is not always what it appears to be. The general way of looking at it is that they're always equal one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of a curve, a mathematical curve called a brachistochrone?
I think I heard that last Tuesday. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, the brachistochrone is a very interesting curve. It was invented by the Bernoulli brothers back in 17-something. And basically, the characteristics of it are really weird. It's a curve, and if you situate it in a gravitational field and you put a particle on there, let's say you put it on the very top of the curve, and the minute you let go of it and it starts to slide down, you start your stopwatch. And let's say it takes exactly 2 seconds to make the traverse of the curve.
Okay.
Okay, now you take the same particle and you put it in the middle of the curve and you let it go and you time it. It takes 2 seconds. If you put it two-thirds of the way down, you let it go. It takes 2 seconds. It will always take 2 seconds, no matter where you put it. And that sounds like it is counterintuitive, but the reason for it is because the curve is designed in such a way that the forces that are acting on the particle are automatically adjusted with respect to the position where you put the particle, such that the resulting acceleration and velocity and whatnot are automatically contoured to secure that result. It's called the curve of least time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is I took 6 years of my life using calculus and trig and all kinds of other nonsense to develop a curve of my own to investigate this same property of the relationship between energy and work. And what I found out is that there is a certain magical situation, and I use the term magical only because I want to highlight the thing. It certainly isn't magic, but what it is a method of adjusting parameters in such a way to find an optimal solution. And what happens is when you do this, you wind up with an amazing situation in which the energy that is accrued as this thing comes sliding down the curve is actually accumulating linearly with respect to the passage of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting because if you drop it straight, it's going to accrue energy as a square law function. If you take the first derivative of a square law function, you're going to get a linear curve, which means that your power is increasing as the energy is increasing. But if you have a situation where the energy is increasing linearly with respect to time, the thing that's interesting about that is the first derivative of that linear function gives you a constant. So what it's saying is that if you fall along the proper curve, you will have a linearly increasing amount of energy but the power that is expended to produce it remains the same, regardless of how much energy you acquire. And that is something that Tesla tried to teach people 100 years ago. And the message is still lost.
Yes, yes. I can conceive of this curve. What is the name of that curve again?
Well, I just used the brachistochrone as an example because it's a very famous curve that has some really bizarre properties. I didn't really give my curve a specific name except that you would call it the curve of linear energy. But the brachistochrone was the model that I used, to come up with an approach to modify space in a particular gradient to give this result. And okay. It's not so easy.
Now, when
it's
you
a
say...
relatively complicated solution. But the thing that I found out, which is very exciting, is that, first of all, energy is totally conserved on this curve. You know, there's a thing that they teach you in physics concerning the conservation of energy, which basically says that if you have something falling and you neglect friction, it doesn't matter if it comes down a spiral, a chute, a ramp, a straight shot, or what, the potential energy at the top is always going to equal the kinetic energy at the bottom, and it doesn't make any difference what the path was. And that's absolutely true. But what is not true is that on certain paths, the amount of work that's done while the energy is transforming from potential form to kinetic form is not necessarily equal to the potential energy at the beginning or the kinetic energy at the end. As a matter of fact, in the example I cited to you, the work done by the gravitational field upon the particle moving on that curve is only 2/3 the value of the acquired potential energy. And so it demonstrates to you that there are systems that have a gain built into them if you're willing to look for them. But
yes.
You also have to have your own understanding of the rules pretty straight when you do this. And if everybody starts mixing power and energy and work and force and momentum and whatever else, and using them interchangeably, you'll never understand a thing.
Yeah. Now, when we consider the fact that petroleum has become the fuel of choice, and it's used as a political tool, it's used as an economic tool, it's used to suppress technologies or to prevent technologies from coming out. It's used to poison people, to develop all kinds of poisons. Some are called chemicals. Some are called vaccinations. These things are put in packages, in clothing, in furniture, in electronic items that people own. The planet is saturated in this stuff, Jim. And they keep telling us we're running out or we're out of it, which is, we know, is a lie. And they use the pretense that it's scarce, and therefore that makes it more valuable. It's insanity. The oil companies themselves are on a hamster wheel, you know, and it takes 2 seconds to get around that hamster wheel, and they keep going around it and around it and around it, and they've been doing that for hundreds of years. So what you're talking about should be investigated just to relieve of ourselves of that worry and that burden, but they wouldn't be able to control us with that, you see. They haven't figured out how to meter it. They don't even acknowledge that what you're saying is true.
Matter if they acknowledge it or not. Anybody that has a little bit of facility with calculus and some curiosity can solve the problem for themselves. The interesting thing about it, though, I mean, it actually goes well beyond what I already mentioned to you. But this curve has some enormously interesting properties. And one of them is that all of the acceleration of the object falling along this curve is actually happening on the x-axis, which means to say that even though the thing is falling straight down, the acceleration is at right angles to the applied force. And that is something which would turn Newton's hair white, because it's not supposed to be that way. But the interesting thing is that mechanisms like this allow you to change energy from one form to another without any waste being involved. As a matter of fact, I think I've talked to you a couple of times about my associate, Mr. Obolensky. One of the things that he did, which is very similar to this, except it was done electronically, he created a delay line using strips of foil in his laboratory. I forget how long they were, but let's say 5 or 6 feet. And he propagated an electrical disturbance down this this parallel set of conductors with the intention of finding out if there was the possibility of exceeding the speed of light with a transmitted signal. It was at the very beginning of his career when he was doing these things. Well, the interesting thing is he pumped an enormous amount of energy into this circuit in order to make this thing operate. And the result was that he blew up half his laboratory. It almost killed him. And when he recovered and started putting things back together again, it was really puzzling to him as to what the heck could possibly have happened. And so finally, when he got to the point where he was at the center of detonation, he recovered fragments of the foil that he had used. And he decided that the only place where the energy could have come from was from this aluminum foil. So he actually put it under a microscope and looked at it, and he found that there were thousands of tiny microscopic holes in the foil that certainly weren't in the unused portion. And he concluded that what happened was that somehow this waveform that he generated caused the liberation of energy from the circuit by literally destroying, you know, tiny little microscopic particles of the aluminum itself and releasing energy in the process. And what's interesting is that going back to the curve I was telling you about, the curve itself has a tendency to add a component of force to the descending particle. And that's another way of saying that there's a certain amount of work that's being added to the ultimate momentum of this descending particle by the structure upon which it is descending. Mm-hmm. And putting that in simpler terms, it's like saying, okay, that means that in theory, under the right conditions, I should be able to engender a situation in which I can literally have an increase in energy in a particular system by virtue of a properly designed impedance structure.
This is what I was going to ask you, and I think you just hit upon it, because I was going to ask if you mentioned that this particle is traveling on the x-axis.
And no, I said the acceleration is limited to the x-axis, actually has movement on the x and the y-axis because it's a parabolic curve.
Yes, yes. What if you were to add a third axis, let's say a Z axis, that made this three-dimensional?
Then you get into a situation where Tesla was playing his games with the propagation of longitudinal waves. That's exactly where that brings you.
Okay, so you can see I understand that intuitively, not as a physicist would, who's working out formulas and that, but I can envision that it doesn't have to be limited to what we limit it to. In fact, it comes from a much higher frequency than where exists in this reality.
Well, it's not only a higher frequency, Don. It's actually a higher dimension if you stop and think of it. Because
of course,
look at it this way: if I have a wave which has the tendency to travel in a spiral as it propagates, okay, and I'm in the three-dimensional space in which that wave is moving, I will see it as a spiral. But if we have a reflection, or not a reflection, I guess a better word would be a projection of that motion on a two-dimensional plane, it's going to look like a sine wave.
Mm-hmm.
And so what actually happens, and you can see this, like you can take a slinky and stretch it out,
yes,
and you can see it, that it's a helix, but if you shine a light through it onto a piece of white paper, it will look like a sinusoid.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it's basically telling you is that there's different characteristics associated with different motions in different planes or different dimensions, whatever you want to refer to it as.
And they can exist simultaneously all the time. Yeah, they can exist simultaneously then.
Well, they do.
And perform.
The problem is, if you only perceive part of it, then you can only access the part you perceive.
Yeah. Well, isn't that sort of demonstrated in how a telescope works? Imagine now if you took this acceleration process that you're describing on a curve and set that in between mirrors where the energy is reflected back to itself, or because of the angles, you could experiment with angles and cause it to go on indefinitely, couldn't you?
Well, now you're asking me something that I don't know the answer to, so there's no point in me,
okay. But do you understand that? Yeah, you understand the nature of my question, though.
Yeah, but you know, the interesting thing is, things do go on forever if you look at them the right way. You know, everything does that.
Yes.
The problem that we have as human beings, Don, is that we grow up in an environment where it's impressed upon us that everything has a beginning and everything has an end, and mm-hmm. including us. And so we tend to think in those terms.
Yes.
But if you go outside our reference frame, the universe doesn't work that way.
Well, but the reason I mention that is because I suppose that if I set myself about the task of becoming qualified to analyze what's going on, something as simple as mirroring that event to cause it to repeat, which doesn't cost anything beyond the price of the mirrors and to start the thing, it should keep on reflecting and possibly building up upon itself. Because
what you're describing is a laser. Light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. That's exactly how it works.
Well,
the original lasers that were, doped ruby crystals with polished ends, once the excitation was established inside, the light just kept bouncing back and forth until it reached such an intensity that finally it ruptured out of the end that was only partially silvered.
Well, that's where impedance comes in.
Pardon?
That's where impedance comes in, which you had suggested when I interrupted with that thought. In other words,
impedance is actually inside the crystal.
Mm-hmm. Now, couldn't there be other devices developed to create other types of impedance that could be used to harness that energy, to direct it, its potential to become used for power?
Well, I've been spending years working on stuff like that, and I'm not going to tell, you know, everything that I know on the air. I don't think that's too smart. But on the other hand, I can tell you this, that the property that everybody calls entropy, which means the disassociation of order and the dispersion of energy, has a counterpart. And that counterpart, called negentropy, causes the opposite to happen, where things become self-organizing. And Ilya Prigogine actually won the Nobel Prize for his work in this area many years ago, and he demonstrated that under certain conditions, you know, systems can be self-ordering so that they can create order out of chaos. And mm-hmm. that goes against the laws of entropy. Well, the interesting thing is, I forget if it was Newton or who it was, but somebody back in the olden days when all this was first being investigated, they came up with the, I know who it was. It was Maxwell. They came up with a concept called Maxwell's daemon, where theoretically you could have the services of a little imp or a devil or a gnome or whatever, that he could have a box that starts off at room temperature, and in the middle of the box is a door. And every time the demon sees a high energy molecule of air coming, he opens the little door and lets that molecule go to one side. And every time he sees a slow moving one, he opens the door and lets it go to the other side. And without doing any work, theoretically, you wind up with a situation where you create a thermal gradient simply by virtue of the fact that you can observe and discriminate the random kinetic energies associated with these particles. Well, the interesting thing about that is, if you do a statistical analysis of the mean free path associated with randomly moving molecules in three dimensions, it's so damn complicated and it's so complex, I don't think that any computer devised could keep track of all of the data. That's how bad it is. Never mind hiring a little devil to do it for you. But the interesting thing is that if you reduce that to two dimensions, the numbers come down so drastically that it defies description. And then if you reduce it again to one dimension, suddenly it becomes manageable. And if you have electrical conductors that are small enough, they in fact can, in certain conditions, approximate the results that you can get in a true one-dimensional thing, because I can only move to the left or the right, theoretically. I can't go up or down or back and forth. And under those conditions, the effects of impedance on drift velocity of the charge carriers starts to become very pronounced. And you know that in all of the years that this stuff has been known about, there was only two or three people that bothered to investigate why this manageability occurs under these conditions. And they were the first ones to talk about things like Cooper pairing and superconductivity at room temperatures and all this other kind of stuff, which you vaguely hear about from time to time. But you'd think that with all that we know today, and with the impending problem of energy, with all this diminishing oil supplies that you were talking about, that a little bit more attention would be directed towards things of this type. But it isn't. As a matter of fact, all independent research is pretty much squelched. You only have the true rogues like myself and Obolensky and a few other people who continue on to try and learn things using their own money and their own time in the hopes that we'll make some kind of a reasonable contribution before we run out of steam. But the government, for instance, used to have tax write-offs or tax credits, you know, for original research. That was all done away with. And now all research that occurs is usually in big institutions or in specific universities that focus on various things, like Stanford does a lot of physics, Princeton does a lot of physics, you know, other places do medical stuff. But the problem with that is that they are, of course, supplied with research funds from the government, and so ultimately the government has call on anything that they develop. And if you're in these places, and I know people who've worked in such institutions, it isn't like being completely free so that you can tune into your intuitive processes and request things from the universe. It's a totally different environment. It's like saying to somebody like Leonardo da Vinci, for instance, okay, you sit here and you paint this. Well, guess what? You don't get the same quality. You don't get the same creativity. You don't get the same spectrum of understanding that you have when you're a free entity. But the only thing that you do get is whatever comes out of it winds up being owned by somebody else. And so it's just another job. It isn't a passion anymore. It isn't an exchange between yourself and God like it was intended to be. It's just another way to milk somebody out of something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why we don't have anything happening.
Yeah, it's an atmosphere of, Jim, we're not looking for solutions here. We're working at finding them. But our intention isn't to actually find them and make them public. We get paid to do the research. So it's very, very insane, actually. Or dysfunctional, at least.
Oh, for sure. And sometimes it's also demeaning. If you've got somebody that has a great deal of talent, for instance, and you put them on a research team or an engineering team, and let's say you're going to be building some huge piece of machinery, and, you know, the guy's got a degree in mechanical engineering or whatever, and he's really excited to be part of a project, and you say, Milton, my boy, you're going to work on this knob. You know, and that's really what they do. They'll give you some absolutely useless thing to work on, and the guy next to you will be working on something else, and it's like nobody really perceives the entire machine. So you go off into your office, and you set up your drafting board, and you work on that knob for the next 6 or 8 years. You'll be seeing knobs in your sleep.
And the guy next to you is actually working on developing the set screw to tighten the knob.
Exactly.
On the post of the on the post
crank
that's being developed for the potentiometer.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that kind of stuff will drive you out of your mind if you have any degree of creativity.
Yeah,
I know I couldn't do it.
For a second, imagine we're just being hypothetical here, that you're Nikola Tesla, and you have all these ideas, and you know you've basically designed the power plant at Niagara Falls. That's one of your major feats. And you've developed wireless communication. We've talked about that. In fact, we talked about that last week. And on many other shows, you and I did some shows on that several years ago that are really off the charts, loaded, packed with information. But imagine, you're Tesla. What goes through your mind when you're dealing with these types in the military, you know, the military-industrial complex that's taken a peculiar interest in your work but is not really publicizing it? How do you approach your work? How do you approach the way they respond to you as Tesla being able to conceive of all of these multidimensional aspects of your work?
Well, actually, I think that I don't know how to explain it exactly, but the feeling that you get is really one. It's a complicated set of feelings, actually, because there are more than one thing going on there. Mm-hmm. One thing is that you start to feel the total frustration and the hopelessness of ever being able to convey in a meaningful way and in a total way everything you know to these other people. And sooner or later you realize it's a hopeless task and you're better off just giving them one or two things because they're never going to get it. The other thing that's very weird and very true is that there's very strong sets of feelings from the opposite side, which are a dichotomy in themselves. On the one hand, they look at you and they say, boy, if we could really understand what this guy is all about, we could turn it into billions and billions of dollars. But on the other hand, they resent that party, whoever it is, Tesla in this case, for knowing what he knows and understanding what he understands because they can't do it. And also they realize that he's different from them. Mm-hmm. And it makes the interaction with the rest of your own species very, very difficult. Now, yeah. Now Tesla survived emotionally by just going along with it. You know, he said, okay, everybody cites me as being, you know, weird or unusual. And so, you know, he basically lived up to the part, except when he had the money, he did it with elegance. You know, he ate at Delmonico's. He wore tuxedos to dinner. He had his own horse and carriage pick him up at the Astor Hotel. You know, and he said, you know, I might as well stand out as long as they're labeling me as an oddity. But what most people do, because, you know, Tesla was a very unique individual in that he is one of the few inventors that was a multimillionaire, you know, in an age when money meant something. And so he could afford to play these games. But nowadays, most people, when they get in that position, they just don't bother to expound upon what they know. You know, if they're involved with a bunch of other people who are, you know, talking about going to a strip club or watching the football game or having a beer, they certainly don't start talking about transcendental numbers and differential equations and brachistochrone curves and things of that sort because they'll be ostracized. So they suppress all of that, even though that's their passion, and they'll do what the rest of the gang is doing. And that's how they get by.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very complicated way to have to live.
Well, this opposition that you're describing is a product or a byproduct of egocentricity and jealousy and most likely denial and fear, wouldn't you say? In other words,
I think fear is the biggest one. It's like, mm-hmm. if you can do something that nobody else can do, few can do, that singles you out, and people are afraid of things they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that even happens in families. If you have one person who's got talents that nobody else has, it doesn't even matter if you're blood related or not; you're still ostracized. It's a very powerful force.
Now, today, what's going on the planet? We know that they're using the HAARP arrays to affect earthquakes in various parts of the world, and this is being done with increasing frequency. And I don't mean raising the frequency of what they're doing as much as I do the frequency in which these events are occurring.
Right, I got it.
One after the other. There is Tesla technology in that. I'm certain of that. And they've probably adapted other Tesla technologies to interface with that. And these solutions or these inventions may have come about not just because of the money, but because of the use of computers and advanced technologies to do the research and development in a more rapid manner. But the general mean feeling that I get, the sense that I get, is that we should be eons beyond where we are in our consciousness about energy and power and work and the approach that has been permitted to exist as if it's the only possible solution. Granted, yeah, you can use water power or nuclear power or coal. You mentioned coal. I mean, why is it that coal has to be burned? Is there not another use for coal in terms of how you're describing these things? Or any other thing, for that matter?
Yeah, well, there's almost an infinite number of ways that you can go. The problem is nobody's encouraging anybody to go there. And then there's another problem, too. By training you to believe that the physics, the chemistry, the science that we're taught is all there is, you're not encouraged to look outside the box. And if you're not looking for something specific, I don't care how many computers you have at your disposal, they're not going to find something by accident because they only can operate on what's programmed into them, and that essentially directs how they operate. So, you know, somebody who's thinking inside the box is going to be programming inside the box, and all that the computer is going to be able to do is solve the problem faster than he can. But to get true creativity and to operate outside the confines of a recognized paradigm, you know, you have to be able to plug into a much bigger reality. And mm-hmm. that's a transcendence of consciousness, which is what we've been talking about.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm asking these questions basically for the listening audience who are not in a position to ask them. Or, you know, I think the average person is going to say, well, if oil is not the end-all to our energy problems, then why do they keep using it? Well, it's used as a means of control. It's used as a means of having this negative impact on the environment. They know this is the case. If it's killing the ecosystem, they should say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we're all wrong about this. We've got to find something else to do the same work. Well, that's there. That's been there before. Been there and done that. They've murdered those inventors, those scientists, those creative individuals that brought solutions to those problems, thinking outside the box, like you're saying.
They do anything to perpetuate the status quo because it leaves them in a position of power, control, and the very products that they have trained us to be reliant upon, fuel, for instance. We can't really do without it very easily. You know, if you have to commute 30 miles to work and you rely on your car, which burns gasoline, in your heart you may say, you know what, screw these people. I won't buy any gasoline. And if enough people did that, it would hurt them, and they'd look for something else. But how are you going to get to work in the meantime? You know, you can say, oh, I'll ride a bicycle. But if you've got a howling wind and driving rain and icy streets and stuff like that, you, by the time you get to work, you have to turn around and go home. So they know they got you over a barrel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. That's been suggested many times, but it's this lie that's going on. What we're really talking about are lies. They lie about what the best solutions are or could be, or that what we have is the best. that's available to us, but it's limited with the vastness, endlessness of time and the universe. there's a short supply on oil. They call it peak oil. By the way, God also himself has a cash flow problem. So when you give to keep your religious organization alive, you're giving it to God. But how do they send illusory money to the Creator? And how does he value that money? See, these are the little questions that are never answered.
Well, I can answer that one. It's very easy, actually.
Go ahead. I'm interested.
Yeah, what they do is this. They take a blanket and they spread it out on the floor in the sacristy, and then they take a basket full of money and they throw it up in the air, and whatever God wants, he keeps. The rest lands on the blanket, and the guy just rolls that up and uses it for himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're witnessing various technologies being used today. Data has become, in and of itself, a technology. The acquisition of data, not to be used for creative purposes, but to exert more power over us. But what's interesting is that they themselves are in pursuit of power, yet the power that they have is not the kind of power anyone else could make use of or would want to use in the way that they're using it.
Well, I understand that. But, you know, it's interesting you brought that up. I actually took time about 5 years ago to make a correlation between everything I know about power and energy in the physics, on the physics side of things, and find, you know, a corresponding characteristic in the financial world.
Mm-hmm.
And my intention was to apply the laws of energy resonance to finances. And unfortunately, I never really completed that thing, but it's a very interesting project because if you dig deeply enough, you can find terms which actually correspond with most of the terms that people are familiar with in electrical engineering, for instance. Like cash flow is the same as current. You know,
mm-hmm. Currency.
Purchasing potential, for instance, would be like voltage, and you can make a very, very thorough list of things that have a correspondence between the electrical world and the financial world, and then if you start to apply electrical laws or laws of physics to the financial side of things, it gives you an enormous insight into what's going on, because a lot of times you'll see things from a perspective that nobody is taught, and when you investigate it, you find out that it's true. And
mm-hmm.
That tells me that you know, these folks who are in control of the situation, they spend an enormous amount of time. I don't know how they do it. They probably just do it by manipulating economics, but on some level that they may not be conscious of, they are making use of laws. Otherwise, it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
The whole universe is nothing more than a collection of laws or rules or whatever you want to call it. I actually learned a lot about how finances work.
Mm-hmm. Could I say that a Federal Reserve note on some level is the same as the contents of a black hole? If I want to equate it in physics?
Well, actually, a black hole is a complicated thing. It's got something, you know, it's based on something real. So actually, a Federal Reserve note is even worse.
Okay.
It's a lot of nothing.
So the black hole would swallow it up, then. It would consume it.
I wish it would consume the whole bloody business.
Maybe there's something for us to work on, you see. Yeah, well, while you were talking about that, I was just envisioning the things that we take for real that are illusions, and you were putting a financial value on all of this stuff, and the benchmark is an illusion. It's actually something geared to work in the opposite direction of abundance, at least on our end. Having us acquiring a Federal Reserve note is like acquiring another's karma.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, you know what you want to try, which is very interesting? My friend Kenny, who passed away here not too long ago, he was a master at doing this. He would go into a bank or something and ask for the manager. And he would say, "Sir, I would really like to have an explanation about something, and I'm sure with your financial expertise that you'll be able to help me out." And, of course, the guy's all puffed up right away and says, "Why, of course, young man." So then he opens his wallet and he takes out a $10 bill, puts it down on the desk, and he says, "Does this say Federal Reserve note?" And he goes, "Of course." And he goes, "Well, how can I pay you with a promise to pay?" That's what a note is. It's a promise to pay. It's not really payment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very legitimate question. Of course, nobody ever gave him an answer.
Well, it really can't be answered in that sense. Or, you know, without revealing the truth about what it is or what it represents.
Well, that was the whole point of the exercise.
Yeah. Well, we find this when we look into issues of health. And they call all of these clinics and medical facilities that have been built in the last 20 or 30 years are all getting these names like medical facility or health treatment center or health maintenance. Yet none of the people that go there are healthy. The ones who are healthy are staying away from there.
Well, the one that I like even better, Don, is when they say on the advertisements, "Come to our facility for the best possible cancer care." Well, I don't want my cancer cared for. I want it to be cured.
Mm-hmm.
It should be addressing the patient, not the disease, you know. But
yes.
Ironically, that, you know, it tells you subconsciously where their concentration is.
Yes, I'm preparing a soliloquy on a couple of infomercials that are out there. It's going to be hilarious.
I always wanted to do something like that. I used to fantasize about actually making my own version of some of these commercials. Of course, they'd never be shown on the air, but they'd be a hoot to watch.
Well, I decided to do that. To two different products that are out there, okay? And it is going to be hilarious. Because if you really listen to what is said and you take it literally, what they say, the second statement that they make in the sales pitch negates the first one. You know? Or if you buy the product, it's going to be so wonderful based on the claims that they make about it that you'll only need to use it one time. Okay. And so why? Okay. You have it for once then. Oh, of course they don't mean that, but that's what they say.
Well, they mean one lifetime. You know, they want to use it for one whole lifetime. You just have to keep on buying it in order to fulfill that obligation.
Or in this case, it's a product that you can use over and over again. But the way they make the statement, it's as if you use it once, the rest of your life, this problem is going to be gone and you're going to be in a state of bliss, not taking anything else into account that may be going on in your life. So our consciousness is constantly funneled in a particular, or channeled into a particular belief system, as you said. And it's reinforced over and over and over again, not just by the repetition of the sales pitch, but that it happens with everything. It happens in the news. It happens in the weather. People are really questioning the weather. I know that you recall what the weather was like when you were just a child.
Very vividly. Yeah.
Yes, I certainly do. And I can recall long periods of time too, not just that summer or that winter of a particular year, but decades of similar weather, or maybe gradually changing a little bit. But then all of a sudden we got into this period of they would make predictions. Well, we're going to have 18 hurricanes this season. We've never had anyone really explain to us outside of biology class that it could be the flapping of a butterfly's wings on the west coast of Africa that precipitates the beginning of the hurricane. But they never tell you exactly what forces came together at any given moment, what those conditions would have to be to create that. Now, they can do that scientifically. They can do that with technology. And now when you start beginning to connect the dots, why is the media telling us something the schools didn't tell us? Why is it in direct conflict with what they taught us in the schools? And how is it that even though they make these claims, no one ever holds them to it? Wait a minute. We had 3 hurricanes. You said there were going to be 18 this year. What caused you to say there were going to be 18? Did you track 18 butterflies flying along the coast of West Africa? I mean, that's how my mind would think. If what I was taught in school was true, then that's the cause of a hurricane, right? Of course, I'm just using that example because that's what they said. I didn't buy it then, and I'm not buying it now.
But, well, see, you bring up a very exciting point, because I've often wondered why it is that when people are confronted with 2 opposing facts, and they're both claimed to be the truth, why they don't react to the conundrum. But they don't. It's just like, oh, okay, is that how it is? Oh, all right. So it just tells me that part of the machinery is already shut down. You know, I mean, 2 things can't be true at the same time. So if they're, especially if they're opposite conditions, and we have that all the time. Good is bad is good, up is down, left is right. Nobody seems to take notice. And the only thing I can conclude from that is that the brain is already damaged. Doesn't matter what you tell them anymore.
Yeah. Well, we know from music that you can reproduce standing waves, very low frequency waves that have a propensity to travel long distances. They do that within a room unless you control those reflections and refraction and use variants of reflection and refraction and absorption, or baffling is another aspect where you separate devices that don't even have to be seen, but just be present in somewhere in the room. It could be up above a ceiling, suspended from chains, let's say, with airspace in between, and use the natural environment to eliminate the problem of the standing wave. Yet when they made the movie Earthquake, for the impact in a movie theater, I worked on a development team that was doing research for producing those low frequencies. They wanted if possible, the speakers to be able to produce the 2 to 1 hertz frequencies. Those are the ones that move Earth. Well, what do you think is going to happen to that speaker cabinet when it's producing that? So you're talking about something that's going to have to be mounted. And if you produce it in the proper manner, you could induce an earthquake in the theater. You could at least cause the wall to collapse or the support for that speaker. And that's, you know, the issue was building a subwoofer that was capable of producing a loud amount of volume down at those low frequencies to make the people feel the sound that they were hearing. Well, only way you can feel the sound is, first of all, to produce that frequency. But it didn't necessarily have to be that low to have the same effect. I found that interesting, and I made that statement that instead of going down to that low frequency, you know, 100 hertz has that same impact at the proper volume level. So you could bring...
Oh, sure. It's, you know, the harmonic of the other one, so it has to.
Yes. You could use a 10 hertz cycle. Now, 20 hertz is lower than any key on an 88-note keyboard, and that's certainly low enough to produce standing waves. But for some reason, it had to be this high-powered system that ended up making people feel like they were in an earthquake. Well, if the desire is to create that impact upon our physical and our mental consciousness, what do you think the impact is on us spiritually with such a low frequency, something so unnatural in the sense, especially if it's an artificially induced earthquake, is the point I'm getting at. You see how destructive the Haiti quake was, or this one in Christchurch, New Zealand. They're using these technologies against us to try to simulate Earth events.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting thing that borders on what you were just talking about. When I was involved with the Tesla research on a really involved, really intense schedule, I was very interested in these Tesla waves that I was talking to you about on different shows. Mm-hmm. And I hypothesized that they have to exist in nature. And if they did, it would be interesting to have a natural source of these waves verify that they are, in fact, what Tesla was using in some of his equipment. And so when I was living in New Jersey, up in New York State, I forget the name of it, but it's right on the Palisades. There is a geophysical station that tracks earthquakes and tremors and things of that nature. And it's a seismology lab, essentially, but I forget the name of it. But anyway, I went up there, drove all the way up there, and told them that I was working on, you know, Tesla-related stuff. They had never heard of Tesla, but they listened politely. And what I was after was, could I examine some typical seismic graphs, you know, that they had recorded over time and see if I could pick out a particular waveform that I was interested in, even if it was only an approximate version of it. And the guy said, well, sure, I don't see any harm in that. And he said, I'll have to get permission from the station manager. So he went and talked to whoever that guy was. I never met him. And he came back and said, no, I'm sorry. He said, that information is the sole property of the United States government, and you're not authorized to examine that stuff. And, you know, I never did get a chance to look at it. And I tried it more than once, too. I went to other stations in different states, and it's pretty much the same thing. So it's almost like they're already aware of certain things, and they study them quietly, and you're not allowed to share in that information. And it gets back to the same stuff of not telling the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Jim, we're about out of time here. Time flew. We are outside the realm of time. There really is no time. So we have to end the show. How's that? But I would like to talk about this more. I'm particularly interested in the aspect that there are all these people out there trying to discover zero-point energy, or the place where they can get energy, an endless supply of energy. I think you get my point without getting into the specifics of the definitions and the way these phrases are used. Do you feel in general, in let's say in wrapping this show up, that aside from yourself, that the general alternative scientific community that's interested in these things is on the right path, or are they basically handicapped by the same belief systems?
Well, I have a sneaking suspicion that there are certain individuals in this country who know how to do those types of things, and they're keeping it to themselves because they know better than to say anything. But mm-hmm. on the flip side of that coin, if you go to another country like Russia, for instance, not only do they know how to do those things, but they're already doing them, and they're doing it with the blessings and support of their government. And I know people who have actually told me that in confidence. So, you know, it's not like nature is so jealously guarding this information that it can never be had. It's just that the mindset has to be there, the support has to be there, and it's the same thing as all the other spiritual adventures we talked about. The intent has to be there.
Yes. Now, obviously, these people aren't who have been controlling. The ones with the power, we'll use that term, okay, just for simplicity. Their intention is to keep us on the same path. Our intention should be what?
To get off the path and break through the wall of the box.
There. That's it in the nutshell. Well, Jim, it's been a pleasure. It's been very educational. And if I run into that curve this week, before next week's show, I'll certainly let you know about it.
Well, you know what? It might be interesting for you to look that up or Google it. See if you can find the Brachistochrome that has a very interesting little history to it. It involved a bet with the Bernoulli brothers.
Okay. Very good. Well, Jim Murray, I thank you for being on the show. As usual, you're going to be with us next week. However, next week will be in the month of March. So I wish you a good night, a great weekend, and enjoy the rest of the month. And we'll see you next Friday.
All right, Don, I'll be here for you. Thanks a lot.
All right. Okay. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting the show. Over at BBS Radio, we had on the sound tonight Seth Hendrick. I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday night when my special guest will be Dr. A. Truat, Ph.D. In the meantime, have a great night. I wish you a great weekend. A night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.